Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today's program will take you around for focusing on products. Starting out with, go ahead, Rabbit.
Well, first of all, it's a chocolate confection that starts out in the headwaters of the Amazon River in Peru. Yeah. And then let's see. Then
ends up in Australia.
Ends up in Australia and then across the rest of the world. Then we've got a little bit of Spanish music, but Spanish music, the products, a lot of them are actually made in New York State. And then finally, I don't know how to explain.
Henry Humdinger's spicy honey.
You want to know about Henry's Humdinger, you better hang on till the end of the program.
He's wonderful. Anyhow, let's listen to, started with Scott Fry of Loving Earth Chocolates. I get homesick, I just said to Scott Fry, when I hear that Australian accent. And Scott Fry is indeed in Australia. He's a native Australian. Well, I guess you can't say that, really, can you?
No.
But you are Australian by birth and upbringing. And in a different part of Australia, you were explaining that you were from northern Queensland.
Yes.
But you're now in Melbourne, which is our part of Australia.
And it's warm up there in northern Queensland, and the bugs are big enough to pick you up and carry you off.
That's for sure. Me especially. I remember, I remember sleeping in that room with the ceiling fan on, right next to each other, and the next morning woke up. I was covered with mosquito bites, and he had nothing on him.
This was at a place called Green Island, which you probably know.
Yes, know Green Island very well. Yeah, just off Cairns.
But you got to a slightly more civilized, at least some people would say, civilized part of Australia, because you're talking to us today from Melbourne.
Melbourne's a fantastic city. It's very, very cosmopolitan.
Isn't it?
A really wonderful food and music scene here in the city. Yeah. It's a great place to be making chocolate. Yeah.
Okay, so that's what you do. Your product is Loving Earth Chocolates. And you sent us some, and they're not only extraordinary, they're also vegan. But let's go back to the beginning and how did you end up becoming a chocolatier?
It was quite a long story. I'll try and give you the short version. I was living in India, studying yoga and doing a lot of community development work, and I was working with some marginalized Adivasi rice farmers who were selling their topsoil to make bricks, mm-hmm. the expansion of Mumbai. And I kind of had an epiphany where I realized to really be able to help these indigenous rice farmers, I needed to have a high-quality organic brand in the marketplace. And that was a long time before I started Loving Earth, but it was kind of a really clear vision that I developed. I realized I needed to have a high-quality organic brand in the marketplace. So that basically we could develop demand for products, and then we could go back to the indigenous farmers and kind of work with them. So anyway, I had the vision. I didn't have the brand at that stage, and I ended up in Mexico after India, working with indigenous communities in Mexico, helping them commercialize their raw materials like coffee and cacao, particularly down in Chiapas, working with Mayan communities. And that's where I learned to speak Spanish, and, you know, I got very well networked in. I discovered cacao and started working with cacao. And then I came back to Australia, and so that's when we created the brand in the marketplace, and then the idea was to, you know, utilize that to go and work with indigenous communities in different places around the world. And at the moment, we're working with a beautiful community down in the Peruvian Amazon called the Ashaninka.
Oh, wow.
And they're kind of based at the source of the Amazon, at the base of the Andes.
It's amazing, isn't it there?
You have to travel. Yeah. I travel about 7 hours by canoe to get up into the communities. And they've got some really beautiful heirloom native cacao. That particular area is where the original genetic material of cacao comes from. So they've got some very beautiful, completely unhybridized native varieties that we're working with.
Yeah, there's a chef there, Virgilio Martinez. Do you know about his project?
I don't know.
Alex Atala, more.
Yeah, well, Alex Atala is more, but I'm starting to think of somebody in Peru. And they have, I can't remember what it's called, but they are collecting all the names, also cataloging them according to altitude, you know, because that's part of it.
Mm.
Yeah,
yes.
It's called the Natura Materialis, something or other. But he has a restaurant called Central and a couple of other things. But he and his wife, Pia, who's also a chef, he's a chef and a restaurateur. Uh-huh. But, and then Alex Atala, of course, in Brazil is doing something similar too.
Mm. Yeah. So we work with the Rainforest Foundation that's based in the UK.
Uh-huh.
They've been working with this community for many, many years. The community's been very traumatized over the years. You know, there's been a lot of violence there because of the Sendero Luminoso.
Right, exactly.
It's also the biggest coca production area in the world. So there's a huge amount of kind of drug trafficking and violence.
Yes.
And the Rainforest Foundation's done a huge amount of work with them to establish land rights, get them basic land rights, work with some of the basic education and medical needs. And then we were able to come in and help them become financially self-sufficient in a way that, is very culturally and environmentally sensitive. So cacao is very central to their culture. And so we've been able to work with the community, establish a cooperative, get them certified organic, help set up post-harvest infrastructure and finance, you know, the harvest. And really, we've been building volume. We've been working with them directly for about 4 years now. We started the first year, we got 10 ton of cacao, and second year we got about 40 ton, and this year we're looking to get about 70 ton.
Jeez.
And we need to get to about 200 ton for them to be completely financially self-sufficient. So it's quite an amazing project.
Oh, you're doing a lot of really difficult work.
The funniest thing is you're probably dealing with people who don't even understand what money is, right?
Yeah, look, we've been very fortunate. There's very strong indigenous leadership in the community. There's a woman called Ruth Buendia, who's a very powerful leader. She's Ashanika, and she's won global environmental and indigenous activist awards. So that really helps, having strong leadership within the community, and we really wouldn't be able to do what we're doing without that. So,
well, but I mean, your caring is probably the biggest thing about it. I mean, they've done research that has revealed lately that the Amazonian communities were not as isolated as they've been led to believe over the years, that there was a lot of outsider contacts.
But most of it wasn't very good. Most of it wasn't very good.
Well, no, but...
No.
But so your mission, basically, you've really explained your mission. Your company, just to make sure it's on the record, is Loving Earth, and that says pretty much... You know, a whole bunch about your mission, but add to that your commitment to the vegan aspect of it, and that's probably your personal preference.
Yeah, look, we want to provide beautiful, high quality, sustainable products that honor indigenous communities and their heirloom products, and for us, you know, vegan products, they're just very sustainable. We use three main plants in our products, cacao, cashew, and coconut. And they're all trees, and they all can be produced in biodiverse, sustainable agroforestry systems. And so we're really coming from a sort of a sustainability perspective and wanting to, you know, work with, and all of these products also, you know, we can source from different communities. You know, like the Ashanika, we sweeten our chocolate with coconut sugar that comes from the nectar of the coconut tree. And we get that from a community just outside of Yogyakarta on the island of Java in Indonesia. And, you know, the product's all processed at the village level. And that particular community has been processing, you know, coconut sugar traditionally for many, many generations. And it's very, very sustainable. Coconut sugar's vastly more sustainable than cane sugar.
Oh, sure.
Now, the biggest surprise I got, and I think I got half of the answer just a few minutes ago, but I'll ask it anyway, because to me, chocolate is brown, if not black.
Uh-huh.
Your chocolate may be a variety of colors, but black and brown ain't them.
So
I think maybe you just explained it by saying that two of the ingredients are not very dark.
Yes, you know, with chocolate, you've got three main types of chocolate or couvertures. You've got sort of dark chocolate, milk chocolate, and white chocolate. And we've kind of replicated those three broad genres of chocolate, if you like, but without using the normal ingredients that people use. People normally use a lot of dairy, you know, very highly processed milk powder, and caster sugar, you know, very highly processed cane sugar. And we don't use those two ingredients. We use coconut sugar, which is completely unrefined, and it's got a beautiful brown color and a beautiful complex toffee sort of caramel flavor.
Oh, yeah, I gave some to a vegan friend, and she said, I thought it was going to be chocolate. It's caramel.
So we're quite well known for our caramel chocolate, which is our take on white chocolate. But obviously none of the ingredients are white because they're not processed. You know, we use whole coconut flesh, and whole cashews as well. And then in our sort of classic dark chocolate, we only have two ingredients, just, 72% unroasted, so raw Ashanika cacao and 28% coconut sugar. We just use the two ingredients.
So you do make brownish looking chocolate.
Yes, we do. And we make it bean to bar. So we obviously work from the bean that we get from the Ashanika communities. The beans travel about 150 kilometers by canoe or 100 miles by canoe before they get to the nearest road. So they're coming from quite isolated communities.
Whatever directed you to do this esoteric and very difficult work?
Well, it was in India that I had the vision. I've always had an affinity with indigenous cultures. I grew up with Aboriginal culture,
yes,
up in North Queensland. I had a strong affinity with that. I've always had a very strong affinity with nature. I grew up on an island, Magnetic Island, just off Townsville. When I was working in India, I realized that, you know, these indigenous communities, the only really assets that they have to offer the world are their, you know, heirloom crops, you know. So that really was kind of the seed of the vision, was to really, what we're trying to do is empower indigenous communities to be able to have a level of cultural autonomy, producing, you know, these heirloom crops that their ancestors domesticated, in a way that's very sensitive to their culture and environment. So that the cacao is grown in an agroforestry system, and it actually helps restore the forest. It helps protect the forest. So growing cacao is actually really good for the planet. It's actually climate positive. You know, it actually helps sequester carbon.
Now, what let's jump to some other things here. I don't know if I want to call them business questions, but I would like to know, like, what kind of reception do you get from the indigenous communities you're working with? And do you notice the bar being raised on their quality of life?
Yes, well, it's a long journey, I can send you a PDF that I've made of just kind of telling the story of the Ashanika community, and they've gone from the late 90s, early mid noughties, just being extremely traumatized. In fact, just last year, 2 years ago, there was a camp found where I think it was about 35 Ashanika people were held captive as slaves by the narcos. By the coca production people.
Yes.
So this community's been very, very traumatized, and now there is a sense of autonomy. Now they've got their land rights. They're now producing cacao. We're selling this cacao all over the world, calling it Ashanika cacao. It's now becoming known. Their community's becoming more known. It's a long journey, and hopefully, over the next decade or so, they will, they'll see their standard of living increasing. They're very, very focused on also maintaining their culture.
Good, good.
And not giving up their culture. They all still speak Ashanika, in the communities, and they live very traditionally. We've just produced a very short video of some footage that I took when I was down there, that kind of shows, when they go out to harvest the cacao, they go out as a community, and it's very unique. I've never seen cacao harvested this way anywhere else in the world. It's very, very special. It's like a whole cultural ceremony, like a cultural event,
I mean, like, how? Can you explain it?
Well, you've got 20, 30 people all sitting around chatting, having fun, cutting the cacao, scooping out the beans. It's a celebration. It's, you kind of have to experience it. I'll send you a link to the video once we get it up online over the next few days. But it's very hard to describe. You have to experience it. It's quite unique. The video gives you a bit of a sense of it, but there's just so much joy, so much love that's just a part of everyday life of these indigenous communities, And, that's how they cultivate and harvest the cacao. And I believe that's unique, and that has an effect on the product.
Now, do you have other sources of income financing for this project, like soft money, foundation grants?
At the moment, we pay a very significant premium for the cacao beans. So we pay probably about, when we came in, they were getting locally about $3 a kilo for their cacao beans.
Yeah.
And we pay them $5 a kilo.
Oh, good.
So it's almost double what they were getting before. There's a European bank called Rabobank, and they help us, finance the harvest. They give us some financing, and we guarantee the loan that they give, and, it's all kind of planned and, yeah, so we're getting by. We're getting by.
Spell out your website, because I think that this is so complicated that our listeners are going to need to go on the website to get a fuller picture. So it's www. What?
LovingEarth.net.
Okay. And how does anyone get this?
Yeah, you sell in the U.S. and in Europe and in Australia.
So we're just starting to sell in the U.S. We're just in the process of, I think, one of our first customers, hopefully soon, it's going to go on the shelves up in the New York area, Mums, My Organic Market. I think they have about 10 or 15 stores up there. We're hoping to get into Whole Foods Market early next year. So at the moment, we're just working on the retailers, looking to get into the different retailers across the US. So hopefully over the next few months, it's going to start appearing on some of the shelves. But at the moment, you can get it. You can actually get it. If you go to our US website, lovingearth.com, on the product pages, there's a link to another website called My Brands, and you can buy it online through that.
Okay, I made a note of that so we can list it.
We're just working to get onto the shelves in stores, in the organic stores in the US, yeah.
So listeners, you heard it here just about first.
Oh, Scott Fry, I so admire what you're doing, and, you know, I really think that this pride in their culture is something that when I was in Australia, I noticed that they had sort of, for a long period of time, wiped that out of the Aborigines, and that was a really big problem for me.
Yes, yes. We work with an Aboriginal community up in the Kimberleys.
Oh, yeah. Well,
Our cousin worked in the
Kimberleys, yeah. It's really remote.
Yeah, we helped them commercialize a bush plum. And in fact, Bruno, the traditional owner from up in the Kimberleys, he's staying with me at the moment here in my house.
I see.
Yeah, they're down visiting and he's staying. And, yeah, so we have a project up in the Kimberleys.
Well. Anyhow, there's lots to do all over the world. I mean, our dear cousins, we have one saving the rhinoceros in South Africa. We have another one for clean water in Melbourne, actually, he's based. Although they really focus a lot on Africa, and he was there for a long time. But we need lots and lots more people to do this. I mean, it's just, there's so much.
Yeah.
Anyhow. Yeah. Well, Scott Fry, I'm really honored to meet you, and certainly enjoyed your story and your product, and keep us posted.
We will. Thank you. Thank you very much for the interview. Really appreciate it.
A really fascinating story, right?
Yes, indeed.
Absolutely no question about that. You wonder what this man is going to do next.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he really has had an interesting life, and he's so committed and thoughtful about everything he does.
Okay.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind having him to dinner sometime.
Yeah, anyway, shall we take a break?
Sure.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Our next story is really rather fascinating because it's a story of a business that started in a family in Spain in the 1940s, somehow decided it needed more things to conquer, so they decided they would start up business in the United States. Today they're making and or distributing wonderful products which are indistinguishable from the homegrown variety in the city we love to visit and where we love to eat charcuterie. The great news is you can get their charcuterie all throughout the United States. And the company's name is Espuma, and our head man is Ignacio. So here's Ignacio.
Ignacio, please tell us your full name. It's Spanish. You are Spanish. And we're talking about Spanish products. So I love how you say your name. Please tell us.
All right. My name is Ignacio Saez de Ibarra.
Yeah, that sounds great. And you are half Basque, but raised in Madrid. I love Madrid. Madrid is a magnificent city.
Yeah, Madrid is a great city.
Yeah, it's so full of art. I could go from one museum to the next. But I also could eat, and I could eat a lot of tapas if given the chance. Your company is called Espuma. Now, the company itself is Spanish, isn't it?
Yep, the company is Spanish. We're a family-owned company from the northeastern corner of Spain, from Catalonia. And it's been in business since the 1947, owned by the same family, the Espuma family. So we carry the name of the family in our brand. Doing business in the United States since 2013.
And your products are so good, which is why we're talking to you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, it's subtitled Tapas Essentials from Spain. Could you describe some of the products that you produce and distribute?
Of course. As a company, since the beginning, since the 40s, we've always been focused on dry cured meats. Meats like chorizo, Spanish chorizo.
We love
dry cured.
Yeah.
Thank you. And serrano ham.
Yes.
So everything we do, almost everything we do is dry cured. We dry by air. We just extract the water from our meat until they're ready.
Just to clarify, these products they're certainly traditionally Spanish, but are they actually made in Spain or are they made in the United States or in Canada?
Okay, we have do have a factory in the United States.
You do,
so,
okay.
Yep, in Gloversville, New York. It's a little town, 45 minutes north of Albany. And we sell into the American market from that factory the chorizos and the dry cured sausages. That's all made in the United States. Even though it's made in the United States, they're all made using the same recipes, formulas, and methods that we use that we've used forever in Spain. So they are exactly the same as what you can find at any tapas bar, you know, gourmet store or supermarket in Spain. What we do import from Spain is the serrano ham.
Okay, I was just going to tell you that. I mean, we've talked and seen a lot of Italian air dried ham products, and mm-hmm. that everybody tells us that you absolutely cannot get the same flavor if you don't have the same condition of the air coming off of the water.
Or wherever it's coming off of.
That's part of the legend behind it. It is true for longer curation products, and but also has to do with the fact that making cured ham is not easy. It's not simple and it's very costly. So we do have everything in place in Spain or Italy or even in France to make the ham, whereas to get started from scratch in a different country, it's very complicated.
Right.
Where we cure our hams in Spain, it's an area called Teruel, which is very hilly, pretty high, very dry, and pretty cold without being freezing. So it's perfect in that sense to cure the hams. But that can be replicated in other places, that's for sure. And there's a lot of people in the United States making really good ham.
We were a place in Italy with the king of Culatella, and the thing that amazed me, he had thousands of these hams hanging up. But it was the aroma that got me. I mean, it just knocked me flat. It was so wonderful.
If you see the old school master ham makers, they basically use their noses. They walk into these rooms with like 15,000-20,000 hams hanging.
Yes.
They smell around and they say, all right, this is good. No problem, next room. Or they say, there's something going on. We've got to check this or that. So everything's in the nose because it's the hams are basically salted and then hang to dry. Uh-huh. You got to have them at a pretty low temperature for 3-4 months and then you can raise it up. But there's no cooking, there's no smoking, there's nothing to them. So it's very important that they develop the right way, because if not, a lot of things can happen.
Now, you make a ham called Serrano, but the more famous, I guess, among gourmets in the United States and around the world for that matter, is called Iberico. Now, what's the difference between Serrano and Iberico?
It's pretty simple. Serrano, it's a cured ham, dry cured ham or air cured ham made with regular pigs, right? The Duroc or any of the regular breeds. Whereas Iberico, it's a ham and same, an air dry cured ham made with the Iberico breed. What's the difference between the Iberico breed and the other breeds? They put on more fat. They can have a more infiltrated meat, so the end product is completely different. And then from there, you can complicate it as much as you want, because you can process an Iberico ham, which is exactly the same as a Serrano ham, meaning that the pigs have eaten feed for their whole lives.
Acorns, not acorns?
No, not acorns. That's the top end,
okay.
Right?
And do they have black feet? Do they have black feet?
Some of them do. That's another myth. Not all the Iberico pigs have black hooves.
Well, they say that on the labels, you know.
But that's not necessarily that's not mandatory. There's a few different bloodlines between the Iberico breed that don't have black hooves.
Well, you know, this whole thing with the authenticity, when you're talking between Spain and Italy, it gets kind of blurry because Italy is known for its olive oil, and yet the biggest producers of olive oil in the entire world is Spain.
What's difficult to explain is that the south of France, Italy, and Spain share very similar terrains in different areas. So diet, it's pretty similar in a lot of ways. So you get air-dried ham in France, in Italy, and in Spain, with differences, with like flavor profiles that differ slightly, with methods of curation that are different, and with pig breeds that are different. They use the Nostrano for the top end hams in Italy. They use the Nostrano pigs. They're great. They're amazing for making ham. In Spain, we have the Ibericos, and in France, they have their own heritage breeds. But it's essentially the same thing. And with olive oil, it's the same thing. We have the perfect terrain for olive oil, both in the south of France, Italy, Greece, Spain, or even the north of Africa. The thing with Spain is that the whole the bottom half of the peninsula is perfect for olive oil. So industrially, it makes a lot of sense to have a lot of olive trees, olive groves, and make a lot of olive oil. And little by little, we're learning how to market it, which before we didn't know how to.
Yeah, so I sometimes think that the country lines, the borders are wrong, because we interviewed an Italian company that had some sort of special octopus. And where did their, it's an Italian company, mind you, and where did their octopus come from?
Came from the Canary Islands.
Yes.
that happens. That happens a lot. You get a lot of different olive oil brands from all over the world carrying Spanish oil in it. Most likely, it'll have some Spanish oil because we're the ones producing the most.
Exactly.
So, but that's just been one thing is the terrain, the other, and another thing is the industry. And the industry always finds a way to make, to try to make things leaner.
I've always wondered. I mean, if we could possibly afford and consume one of those wonderful Iberico hams. I mean, I've always wanted one of those, what are those things called, the jamón, the thing that you put the leg on and then you slice it off.
Jamonero. That's a pretty normal, usual implement in Spanish households. Not everybody has one, and as society evolves, there's, families tend to go to easier ways to eat jamón, But I have one at home, and I love it.
Yeah, I'd love to have one.
The problem is that Iberico ham in the U.S. is, as a company, we're not into the Iberico ham business. Mm-hmm. So I really don't understand why is it so expensive in the United States.
Oh.
I think Serrano ham has a very fair price. Prosciutto has a very fair price in the United States. But jamón Iberico is through the roof. And that keeps people away from it.
Well, some chef was explaining, probably it was Jose Andres, that there's all this extra cost associated with having to cut the hooves off for the United States.
No, yeah, but that's not enough to make you $400 a pound.
No.
I think the answer is it's kind of like a cult.
I think so.
One thing is absolutely true, and that is that if you want to have acorn-fed Iberico ham, which is the top end, what gives it its appeal and the myth and the legend behind it, you can only feed one animal per in acres per hectare. So the amount of country, the amount of land that you need feed one pig is huge.
Yeah.
So you can only have so many every year because those pigs eat acorn for and they have to put on the weight from November till January, February, right? That's when the acorns fall to the floor, and that's when the animals are finished on acorns.
Why do pigs like acorns so much?
It's not only acorns. That's what it's the Iberico pig and the Iberico hams are a result of a certain environment that happens in the southwest of the Iberian Peninsula, in which the farmers have sheep in the summer or goats in the summer. Then they get some. They might even plant some things in between, and then in the winter they take advantage of what falls from the trees, which is acorns, and the fact that there's fresh grass and a lot of, other worms and little things that pigs like.
Oh, they do worms, too. I didn't know that.
Yeah, they eat everything. Pigs eat everything. So whatever's on the floor, they would eat it. But what we have to understand is that for a farmer, that's free food. Because they don't have to buy it anywhere.
Right, they just sort of let the pigs loose in the woods, right?
Exactly. So over centuries, they found a way to make a great ham out of it. But that's just the way they're called dehesas. It's a very specific environment in the southwest of Spain. And those farmers work all year round in the dehesas, and they only have the pigs out for 3-4 months. And the rest of their lives, they basically, they eat animal feed. So that's another myth. They don't eat acorns all the
all
time.
Time. Okay. Boy, they're you're telling finished. Us a lot of secrets here, Ignacio.
Yeah.
So
that's and if those pigs, if they would only eat acorns, they wouldn't put on the weight. They need to eat everything else that's on the ground around the acorns as well, because it's just a balance.
Got it. Now, we're talking about these wonderful products. Now, let's talk a little bit about how people can get a hold of them.
All right, we currently focusing our efforts in the New York metro area, which is close to where we have the factory, and in Florida, because we basically the Hispanic communities, the Latino communities that have our products in their diet. So we are starting there, and we do have some business in Texas as well and in other parts of the country, following either higher-end retailers or the Latino communities. And, of course, you can get us in Amazon and online visiting our webpage and, any other way. We're building the business right now, and we are still putting on the foundations of the company in the United States.
Why are you in Canada, in Toronto?
We as a company, Espuna sells to over 50 countries in the world. Uh-huh. And so we export a lot. And one of the countries we sell to is Canada. We don't have a factory in Canada, but we do have a pretty good market. So I manage both the U.S. and Canada from Toronto. Toronto, it's a very...
It's probably one of the most cosmopolitan cities I've ever been in.
Absolutely. It's a great quality of living, and I'm very central between New York, Chicago. I have direct flights into Florida every day, you know. The Pearson Airport is great. You got direct flights to all the major cities. Mm-hmm. So for my job, I travel a lot, and Toronto is great for that.
See, the only thing I didn't like about Toronto was every time you turned around, somebody was pushing that, you know, that thing with the curds and the French fries. Which I think is totally disgusting. Watch. Poutine. I'll get so much bad vibes.
Poutine.
I'll get Poutine. So much bad emailing. People will really call me out on that, I'm sure.
That's a big, big trend in Canada right now. And I guess as in every other aspect of life, you get a lot of good of, you get the good and the bad with it.
Well, let's just recap for everybody with the spelling of the product name and the website. Go ahead, Ignacio.
The company is called Espuna, and the brand is Tapas Essentials. And the webpage is Espuna, Espuna, .es.
ES for España.
Well, we were absolutely delighted. We ate everything you sent.
I hope you liked it. You know, we make it with our heart in it. It's done the same way as it is in Spain, and it's a really high quality product. We only get the best cuts of the pork meat for it. We use paprika from La Vera. That's another thing
that
Spain is very well known for, the La Vera, because if I have a minute, I'll tell you another story.
Okay.
You know where paprika comes from?
Hungary.
Well, it comes from peppers.
All right, but you know where the peppers originally come from?
Well, you're going to tell me Spain. I thought it was Hungary.
No. They're original from America.
Oh, right.
They would be, of course. That's where all chilies come from, America.
Yep. So when the conquistadores were in America, they brought back to Spain the bell peppers, and a lot of those conquistadores came from an area of Spain called Extremadura, from a couple of valleys. And luckily enough, in one of those valleys, those bell peppers thrive. So it's they grow very well, and they figured out a way to preserve them and to preserve their properties. So they started smoking them, drying them, and grinding them. Uh-huh. That's paprika. So
as to
this day, they do it exactly the same way. They smoke them in these wooden barns, uh-huh, and they grind them, and that's it. There's nothing else. So paprika has a lot of really good properties. All the oils from the peppers have
healing
conservative properties, so they keep the product for longer. That's why they started using it in curing meats.
Yep. You know, just talking to you makes me really long for Spain. I love your country. And we haven't been for 2 years, have we?
Right.
Another thing that's interesting about Spain is that in North America, you drive for an hour and you're essentially in the same place. In Spain, you drive for an hour, okay, and you've crossed, like,
exactly,
you're in three different worlds altogether. So it's really, really diverse in food, people, and what you name
and
it.
And language.
Wine.
Language.
We
interviewed Santa Santa Maria, and he refused to speak anything but Catalan.
Yeah. That's
Catalan. He spoke Catalan. And yeah. I have no idea what he said.
Because he also died. He also died. That was kind of careless of him.
Well, if you ever interview someone from the Basque country in Basque.
Oh, yeah, I know. Yeah.
That's like a completely different, that's a language that
I can't even pronounce it.
To any other.
Yeah, I can't pronounce it, actually, but anyhow.
It's very interesting, and it's culturally very, very rich.
It is, and I love the Basque country. That's why I hit on it right away that you said you were Basque.
It's a very special place. We
wish you continued success as your company grows, which it's sure to, listeners. This is the real stuff. There's no question about
absolutely.
That. And so get some.
Get some.
Exactly. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Continue
it was a
success.
Pleasure speaking to you.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Next up, I will say the product's called Henry's Humdingers. And the person is called Henry Miller. And let me tell you, he is starting a business like at 11 or 12. He is
kind of unusual
entrepreneurial protege. And certainly is unusual. And the product is splendid. Let's talk to Henry. Well, I just learned that who I've been calling Henry Humdinger is actually Henry Miller. Welcome to On the Menu, Henry.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, now, your story is rather compelling. Tell us again, about what started you thinking about bees at age 11. You were now 20, you said. Okay.
Well, when I was 11 years old, I sat next to a beekeeper on a plane. And I started talking to him about bees, and it fascinated me. And he told me about colony collapse disorder and how the bees needed help. So directly after the flight, I asked my mother for a beehive for my 12th birthday, and for some reason she got me one. And after that, I had just so much honey, I didn't really know what to do with it. Mm-hmm. My first hive made about 40 pounds of honey.
Jeez.
And I had... What does a normal person do with 40 pounds of honey? So I ultimately just started trying to sell it and realized that everyone had access to sweet honey already.
Yes.
And it wasn't anything new.
Right.
So one day while I was cooking in the kitchen, I was looking online at recipes that used honey, and I realized a lot of them also incorporated spices. And I thought, hey, why not try mixing the two together? And ultimately created Spicy Honey, and in turn, my business that I run today.
Okay, now your business is actually called Henry's Humdingers.
Yes.
Right, and I guess I could just picture
So do you want to explain that one, Henry's Humdingers?
A humdinger is the best of something, and we were trying to figure out names for the company, and a lot of our original names had alliterations as the flavor names, so we thought it'd be pretty cool to do another alliteration for the company name. And my grandfather actually called in while he was in Paris with the idea for the name, and we liked it, so we ran with it.
So you come from a foodie family.
In a sense, my father loves to cook. My family has never really done anything like a business in food before. So it's all very new for us. Well, not anymore, since we've been running it for a while now. But it was just kind of something that happened. It was not really planned. It just, the more we started pursuing the company, the more we just started getting invested into it.
Now, where do you live, Henry?
I live out in Washington State, about as far northwest as possible.
Okay.
Almost about 20 minutes from the border.
So you're near Port Angeles?
I'm out in Deming, Washington.
Okay. Port Angeles is fairly near, right?
Yes.
We have a friend who's been on the program before who cooks, and she has a camp called Pie Camp.
Oh, yeah.
in Port Angeles, Washington. And I don't know, can you put honey in pies? I suppose you can.
Sure, I guess so.
We have several flavors ranging from spicy to sweet. And you'd be surprised at the versatility of honey. Most people assume honey is just for tea and toast. But when you start infusing spices and flavors into them, it really expands the usage of the product.
Now, how many flavors in your hand? It's called Handy Honey, right?
Yes. Handy Honey is our newer line of squeeze bottles that we have. And we have 6 flavors. And it ranges from habanero and lime to vanilla and nutmeg.
Yeah, it's good stuff, I'll tell you.
No, the reason I asked the question about where you are is because I guess you need to be somewhere where there are lots of bees, unless you're using all the product of your own hives.
We did originally, but then the demand just totally started outgrowing what we were able to produce. So now we do buy other honey, and I focus a lot more on the company now. Just because the scale we're at, there's no way we could do both full-time keeping bees and running the business.
Right. No, the person that Anne was talking about a little bit earlier, who is in charge of a lot of hives in London, she said that the bees that come from the St. Ermin's Hotel actually get their... What do they call it? They get
pollen.
They get their pollen from the gardens of Buckingham Palace, which makes it kind of really royal honey.
Now, you have other products that are not in the Handy Honey line, right?
Yes, we have our Henry Sumdinger's line as well. It's all under Henry Sumdinger's. The Handy Honey is just another packaging for the honey that makes it easier. Our original flavors are all in glass jars and have names like Grumpy Grandpa, Mama Drama, Diabolical Dad. And the Handy Honey is a more kind of efficient way of doing it, a little bit more practical sometimes in the plastic squeeze bottles.
Yeah, now, I mean, you seem to be a born marketer, I might tell you.
Thank you.
I love your names of your different, and you know, you have some interesting facts that to offer about the honey. You point out that they found honey in ancient Egyptian tombs that were still usable. That's true?
Yes, honey is one of the only things in the world that will never expire.
Uh-huh.
But you had to put an expiration date on it anyway, right?
Yeah, they told us we had to put an expiration date on it, and we did the maximum, which was 5 years, I believe, is what the maximum is right now. And I told them it doesn't really matter because the honey won't be on your shelf that long. You'll eat it because you're going to like it so much.
Well, I do. I must confess, I squeeze it on yogurt.
He has a whole book of recipes, so.
But I just like to eat it because it tastes so good.
Well, just in case somebody else wants to know other things to do with it, it's probably on your website as well, but you have a little leaflet you give out with it.
Yes, we do have a little cookbook because the hardest problem about starting a new category such as spicy honey is people don't really know what to do with it. They see it and they kind of scratch their head and they're confused. So consumer education is easily one of the biggest hurdles that we've had to overcome. And one of the ways we found that best helps that is including the cookbook so people can associate what they would do with the honey.
You have a mission sort of beyond that too, don't you, having to do with the colony collapse?
Yes, we do donate a portion of our profits to help bee research to help save the bees, because as everyone knows, the bees are dying at an alarming rate, and it's not good. The bees are so important for the environment and the food chain and pollination. It's just something that really needs to be talked about more. People act as if, oh, it's the bees sting, Not everyone likes bees, which is really kind of crazy considering how much they really do for us.
Oh, I mean, I don't think we could survive having no bees. I mean, who else would pollinate?
Exactly.
I once read a book called The Secret Lives of Bees. Did you read that?
I have read that book.
Yeah, it's wonderful, isn't it?
It is. A lot of interesting bee facts in the book. One of the things that stuck out was one of the facts in it was the first thing people don't realize about bees is that they do everything that they do in complete darkness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that how do they do that? They have some sort of radar system.
Well, they just know their way so well around the hive, and it's just hive mind, and they're just able to communicate through dancing and several
I love that dancing business. That's cool.
But if they can't see each other dancing, what do?
They can tell.
And they can tell. So they do it by the movement of the air, or what?
I'm not entirely sure about that. I just know that they communicate through dance. And that they do. They also do that when they're pollinating flowers, and they know where more flowers are, and they can communicate where the nearest water source is. It's pretty amazing how well structured a hive gets, and how they're able to sustain it the way they do.
Right. You can order this probably right off your website. Which can you give me your website?
It is henryshumdingers.com.
Henryshumdingers. Okay.
But do you go out through Whole Foods or anybody like that as well?
We're trying to get into Whole Foods. Whole Foods is a tough nut to crack.
Sometimes, oh, sure, yes.
Larger chains like that are very hard to initially get into, but we feel as though when we eventually do get in, it'll be a perfect fit for us.
Yeah, I think it would be, and I think your packaging is very sophisticated.
Thank you. My father will love to hear that.
Oh, he's the one who did that? So you have your whole family involved in this, huh?
So do you employ your father and mother?
Yes, it is the definition of mom, pop, and son. We the three of us are the people who run it day to day. And it's our brainchild now at this point. I mean, I started the company, but I wouldn't be anywhere without my loving venture capitalist being my parents.
What about running the business now? Not about the bees, but about running the business. What was the most surprising thing you encountered about running a business?
Just how hard it is to get into some of these chains. You think because we have this product and we went on QVC and it was one of the highest rated food products they've ever had on QVC and people love it and we've heard nothing but great reviews about it, and so the product's good and we know people like it, but it's just so hard to get into these larger stores. I always assumed that if people liked your product and people would buy it, that you could just kind of. When I was younger, I thought you would just walk up and say, hey, can you guys sell my product? And they tasted it and thought it was awesome. And I very quickly realized the harsh reality of just how hard it is. But slowly but surely, we're making our way.
Yeah, I mean, it's shelf life's at a premium in supermarkets.
Are you on Amazon yet?
Yes, we are on Amazon.
And so you'll be on Whole Foods pretty soon anyway.
Yeah.
Hopefully, I know. After the purchase, we're hoping that business carries over.
Well, could very well be. I didn't mean that as a pun.
I missed that one.
Yeah, no, I did too until it came out of my mouth. Well, Henry, I think you're really learning so much. I mean, you're doing this full time. You're not in school or anything like that, right?
I am in school. I am going into my junior year of college.
Okay, so you have to do this in your spare time, no less.
Yeah, I'm not able to do as much of the day-to-day as I used to now that I'm off at college, but I still go out to the food shows. I still make a lot of the decisions. I talk to my parents all the time. Well, I mean, I would have anyway, but a lot of business talk still. And it's pretty crazy juggling being in a fraternity, being at school, running a company. It's I like being busy.
Well, you certainly must be.
Just as well. Huh? Well, congratulations, Henry. Congratulations to Mr. and Mrs. Miller. And
I used to be Ann Miller, by the way.
Yeah, you did.
Yeah. So
she wasn't married to Henry, though.
Yeah. Anyhow, Henry, I hope. I don't know what's next. You're getting into the chain seems to be the most the thing that preoccupies you the most at this point. And I guess the marketing is the key, but you're going to have ongoing product development, I'm assuming.
Yes. Our one concern we do have is, though, we don't want to make too many different flavors and spread ourselves too thin. We're really looking to push the flavors we have now until we get to a little bit more sustainable point in the future, and then look towards expanding, finding new venues that we can pursue with the Henry Sumdinger's line.
Right. I think that's a smart move, because I've seen chocolate companies in particular go under as a result of that.
Where they make like 20 different flavors.
Yeah.
When they really should be selling 5 or 6.
Yes. And one last question. You say it's raw honey, and raw honey is good for you. What's the alternative to raw honey? Pasteurized?
Raw honey is honey that has not been heated over 120 degrees, which pasteurizes it.
Okay.
And the way to tell the difference between raw honey and not raw honey is the raw honey will crystallize, mm-hmm. and it's more pure. A lot of the honeys you see in stores can end up being technically honey, but sometimes they're sourced from other countries where the regulations on it are not as intense.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes it can be the equivalent of almost sugary goo.
Yes.
Raw honey is definitely the way to go.
And the neat part about it is, even after it's crystallized, you can still eat it out of the jar with a spoon.
Exactly.
All right.
I do that.
Miller. Yeah. Henry, lots of luck to you. And if you come up with something different you're doing, let us know.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Henry. Bye.
Bye.
We did tell you, didn't we? We did warn you you'd finish up in some unusual places with some really interesting people. We hope you enjoyed today's show and that you'll join us again same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye-bye.